given and remained in your place for your season and had the overfitted. But listen, the high fence more sense reason. Did you hear that bear said, monkey, we'll get out of here fair and square? They left the gate open wide. So, my bride, here is my hand, where is your call? Try and understand my plan, Ursula. My heart is a furnace, full of love that's just enormous. Now you know that we must unlearn this, allegiance to a life of service, and no longer answer to that heartless headmonger, nor be his accomplice. The Shuriken with art is hostile, but Ursula, we've got to eat something. While still within the borders of the land, that men is girded, all double bolted and tied, fisted, until we reach the open country, steeped in milk and honey. Will you keep your fancy clothes on for me? Can you bear a little longer to wear that leash, my love? I swear by the air I breathe, sooner or later you'll bear your teeth. But now, just dance, darling. Come on, will you dance, my darling? Darling, there's a place for us. Can we go before I turn the dust? Oh, my darling, there's a place for us.
Next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and freakradio.org on your internet dial, it's Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Today is December 14, 2006, and away we go. And that was Ann Feeney. Looks like we got a phone call coming in here. Let's check it out. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Your signal's a little bit quiet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. How's it sounding now?
I'm not hearing anything.
Really?
Out over the air.
Ah, interesting.
There we go.
We'll see
there
what...
There we go. Okay. Great. Well, I'm hearing you now.
Excellent.
Have a great show, Robert.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for being there.
Bye-bye. And, hey, I'm glad somebody's keeping an ear on the radio because I guess last show, I come on Sundays as well as Thursdays, this fine program disappeared, can you imagine, for at least 5 or 10, possibly 15 minutes. No, we can't allow that to happen. So give a call in if you hear technical problems or if you've got some more reality-based problems or some reality-based criticisms to pass on to us. The phone number here is 427-3772-427-FRSC. Free Radio Santa Cruz is us. And you, too, if you want to be a part of it, at least a part of the whole discussion that I'm going to be going into for the next 2 hours. We'll be having two guests, I'm hoping. One of them, both by phone, is Richard Quigley. Richard is a freedom fighter. He's an irascible, unregenerate, sexist, racist, motorcycle rider who has pioneered, sounds a little quixotic to some of us, but in another sense it's not quixotic at all, the right to choose whether to wear a motorcycle helmet or not. You've probably, if you've been a local for a while, you've followed this in the papers. He has also been a regular commentator on radio station KSCO, sort of the nightmare AM pro Bush station, which has been blasting out its propaganda for years, but also you get the Odd program, which is actually of some interest, and Richard Quigley's Tuesday show. I think it's on Tuesday at noon, or actually 12:15 to 1 o'clock, is a pretty good show. I recommend it. He exposes police misconduct, talks about bureaucratic corruption. He actually, though he supports the Iraqi war, he opposes torture, and he's very intense on that. And it's nice to see some dissent even within the ranks of the Iraqi genocidal warrior faction. But we're going to have him on the air talking about other issues than that, issues involving the rights of poor people, which he's very strong on in terms of fighting discrimination by gentrification masters, in whether it's in downtown Santa Cruz or most notoriously at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. And that's a large shopping center out in Aptos, which is about 5 miles south of Santa Cruz, kind of an upscale community, which at least in the nostrils of some of us is a little too upscale in terms of running off locals who don't look as homogenized or who aren't as nice to the police and security guards and the police state mentality as they might be. We've talked about the situation in front of the Aptos Coffee Roasting Company, the police substation there, the Safeway there, and the plight of Jerry Henry, the activist who actually is jailed on $100,000 bail for the crime of essentially picketing and protesting a store when it excluded him and a sheriff substation and security, what would you call them, the system of security, the first alarm folks, when they were running off young people and Jerry was informing them of their rights, Jerry Henry, and they went after him and they're still going after him. He still has a stay-away order from the Aptos Coffee Roasting Company, although he's been a native of Aptos all his life, and he's chosen to make a stand there. Anyway, Quigley is a man who has actually very close relations with the police departments, I think, much closer than I do. He has a lot of respect for them. It's kind of it's in line with some of his more conservative views on some issues, but he has no patience with police misconduct or abusive use of authority, and he's pretty clear on that issue and also quite humorous, quite colorful, and quite vivid in his descriptions. And I'm hoping we can, in fact, I think I'm going to call him right now. I actually had a show with him yesterday on Becky Johnson's Club Cruise. We filmed a show which should be airing on Club Cruise. I think it's Channel 27. It's either 25, 26, or 27, but I think it's 27. Club Cruise airs Thursday nights and Tuesday nights at 7 o'clock, in case you want to see Club Cruise. Recently, it's been having a lot of local stuff. Sometimes it has what I regard as Zionist trash on it, although others would say otherwise. But half the time, there's a lot of stuff that's very, I think, pertinent locally and a tribute to Becky's good work in that area. Anyway, this show with Richard should be airing, a couple of weeks. Let me see if I can catch that man online here. I'm ringing him now, seeing if Richard is available to chat with us. Richard is terminally ill with lymphoma, and he's been struggling and doing a great job of keeping his head above water, but sometimes he's not in the best of condition to talk, so we may not be able to reach him in that condition. And if we don't, we'll have to try another time. It looks like
quick. I missed your call.
Looks like we caught his machine. Hey, Richard, it's Robert. I'm calling you live from Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to get back to us and pick up the conversation from where we left it off last night, I think we were talking about some of your concerns about the current sheriff's office and how they're treating medical marijuana. Get back to us at 427-3772 anytime before 7, if you can, and we'll talk. So hope to hear from me. If not, we'll do this again maybe on Sunday, sometime between 9:30 and 1 in the afternoon when the show comes back. Again, 427-3772. So it looks like Richard is not available at the moment, so I will have to proceed with a few alternate items, which I have luckily scheduled here. Here's an interview I did today with someone who called me over for some assistance and advice. I didn't have a lot of assistance and advice, but his story is kind of a cautionary tale. So let's hear it. It's around 5 after 3 on December 14th in the parking lot here behind UC Santa Cruz Extension. No, Farmers Market is parking lot number 4. We used to have a porta potty in this lot for people who had to take a piss, but Parks and Rec decided that poor people don't need to piss. And rich people can afford to go pay a bar or something. Anyway, that's irrelevant what I'm talking about. I'm talking with...
My name's Michael Wells.
And Michael, you're a man facing the dreaded marijuana ticket.
Got busted for possession of.
And you were, you were driving all over the road shooting people, or what happened?
I was minding my own business, and I take it I was profiled by an officer, and he lighted me and lit me up with a spotlight, and I was at his mercy.
And where did this happen?
Los Gatos Boulevard.
This was over the hill?
San Jose.
And you were you had the criminal camping gear in your vehicle?
Yeah, I was guilty of being homeless.
And so this officer pulled you over and then spent how long searching your car?
He detained me for about 40 minutes, and I regretfully allowed him to search my vehicle, and that's where my mistake came.
And what did the officer have any commentary as he sort of trampled your rights and rifled through your vehicle looking for evidence of numerous other crimes?
Well, I feel like he was trying to provoke me into doing something stupid in a real professional manner.
How did he do that? What was he doing?
His basic overall attitude.
Did he say anything specific?
Said I failed. I didn't signal, which I believe I did. Pretty sure about that.
It's really hard to deal with, to win traffic tickets, I think. And you now have a ticket for possession of marijuana?
Possession of marijuana in vehicle.
In vehicle. And how long did it take the cop to find the marijuana?
About 2 minutes.
You know, he searched your person?
It was on my person, actually, yeah.
And again... I advised you, and you acknowledged that it probably wasn't the wisest thing to consent to a search, but there's a reason why one does in those circumstances. Describe what that reason was.
Intimidation. Yeah. I just felt like he had the upper hand and that he was going to make me sorry if I tried to, you know.
Fuck off, copper!
Exactly. I felt that he was, you know, he wanted me. You know, he profiled me, and I, you know, I should have been a little quicker on my feet and had my wits about me and told him.
Late at night and you were alone, right?
Right.
What time of night was it?
About 11.
Wow, and you spent 40 minutes going through your vehicle?
40 minutes on the curb. 40 minutes on the curb.
Now, did he handcuff you? Or?
No, he called for backup so he could look through my vehicle, and he went through every single inch of it to a point where my possessions, it took me quite some time to put things back in order.
What did the other, how many officers came to assist him?
One other.
Did he seem to approve of this behavior?
Oh, he just kept his mouth shut and just hem-hawed me.
This is the Los Altos Police Department?
This is Los Gatos.
Los Gatos Police Department. And when did this happen?
This was on the 6th of November.
And so now you're trying to find a way to how to deal with this ticket, whether to plead to it, where the fine is how much?
I was told it was going to be close to $200. But I'm on public assistance, and... I can't afford to be paying out, you know, any kind of ridiculous fines for something that just didn't do anything wrong.
You live in your vehicle?
Yes.
Now, do you smoke marijuana merely recreationally, or do you have actually other uses for it? Does it have some medicinal use for you?
I work a really hard job, and it's I'm like everybody else. I use it as medicine, and I use it for recreation.
And what kind of work do you do?
Stonemasonry.
And had you been working in the last week before you got stopped?
I've managed to just stay, just to have enough money to just get by and stay off public assistance as much as I can. And
And are you on public assistance or off or just on and off?
I was going to get some food stamps.
Not that it's any of my fucking business.
But that was part of the reason why I was so upset by this, because all my camping gear was tucked away in the back seat. And, you know, it was obvious that I was,
you felt somewhat humiliated by having your entire life exposed to this rather hostile and... Sounds like a fishing expedition.
Yeah, it was a fishing expedition, and I felt violated, and I don't feel like I did anything wrong, and he didn't give me a citation for what he said he pulled me over for, so...
Really?
Really.
Interesting. So he didn't give you a citation for lifting, because he had a juicier thing to marijuana in a vehicle.
Yeah, like I said, we don't want peace to break out, and they're not going to allow it over there in San Jose, for sure.
I think the evidence will show up in court, or will it have disappeared by the time...
I don't know, but I'd sure like to get the evidence back.
And we're talking about how much marijuana?
Less than a gram.
Well, you're such a really serious criminal, I'm feeling a little nervous here in the parking lot with you for my own sake. Do you mind if I search you?
Absolutely not.
No. That's the wrong answer. You refuse to be searched.
Now I refuse to be searched.
Yeah, that was what... there's a woman named Katya Komisarek, who's an attorney in town, who gave us a special seminar for people how to deal with the police. And while I don't agree with everything she suggested, one thing she suggested I did agree with, which is that her basic advice, well, is... Particularly if you're dealing with a strange police department, the first thing you say to a police officer comes up to you is, am I free to go? And the second thing you say is, am I under arrest? And the third thing you say is, I have nothing to say. I'd like to speak to my attorney.
And there's a lot more to this tape, but fortunately we have a man who's had some direct experience with officers of the law and also lawless officers with badges. I'm referring, of course, to none other than Richard Quigley. Hi there, Richard.
Doing?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
Oh, we're back on that hookup where I can barely hear you, but if you can hear me, that's okay.
I think I can hear you. I'm pretty sure. In fact, yes, I can hear you, in fact.
Wow.
Yes.
Modern technology is just a wonder, isn't it?
It is the greatest. I've given you a brief introduction about 10 minutes ago. I discussed everything ranging from your physical condition, terminal, that is, to your... you know, your history as a successful challenger of the helmet law. And I guess what I wanted to get back to, though, is more important than that, what I heard you talk about Tuesday on KSCO and its implications for poor people, the law coming in January 1st that has talks about insurance requirements and cops and can take, I guess, get active information from insurance companies if you're not insured, and your kind of brief thumbnail history of how that all kind of came down. I know it took a while to set it up on KSCO. Maybe you can do it even a bit more briefly now.
Well, I don't know how to tell it. You know, it's taken 100 years for them to do it. It's kind of hard to do it in 100 seconds.
We'll take 250 seconds or maybe even 300.
Yeah, well, basically what's happened is that the insurance industry's figured out that the best way to make a living insuring people on the roadways is to convince the government to regulate the hell out of roadway use. And so over a period of years, they've slowly but surely developed this vehicle code, which regulates just about everything we do in a car and on the roads and all that kind of stuff, to the point we're stifled by the expense. And it's all about protecting the pay window of the insurance industry. There's very little direct benefit to us, especially in relation to the fact that we've lost our right to use the roadways. You know, they now claim driving is a privilege and so on. But this last bite was a little bit more obnoxious than any that I've seen along the way. And it's the one where the government directly empowered the insurance industry to report you if your insurance lapses, and to the DMV, at which point your registration for your vehicle will automatically be suspended, and you're subject to impound.
Now, how is this a change from the current situation today in December 14th?
Well, used to be that you'd have to get a ticket for driving without insurance, and then they suspend your license for a while and make you buy it. But now they can just, I mean, the insurance companies now have control over whether or not your registration remains valid. And that's, you know, talk about big business corporate corruption stuff. I mean, I don't know, how many industries do you know that regulate an essential part of your life to that kind of a degree? I think it's kind of unprecedented.
So the way it is now, what happens is if you are, until January 1st, you have to be stopped for something other than an insurance deficit. I mean, the police officer doesn't look at your license, start running your license plate and looking to see if you have insurance, unless he has some other basis for stopping you, right?
Yeah, and initially it was set up when they... There's been several progressions of this. It didn't happen overnight. But along it used to be, first you'd have to be in a wreck to have to show proof of insurance. Now it's, you know, are your papers in order? You have to, anytime you're stopped by a cop, you have to show your license, registration, and proof of insurance. But now if you can show your registration starting January 1, that is proof of insurance, because you wouldn't have registration if you didn't have insurance, because the insurance industry would take it away from you.
Now, you pointed out on KSCO last Tuesday, or maybe it was Tuesday, I think, when you spoke, that there was a California Supreme Court decision which essentially it upheld the right to require mandatory insurance, but also suggested that if you couldn't afford it, there was some kind of an out for you, and that the same state agencies that were requiring you to get that insurance had to somehow make it available in some way, right?
Well, yeah, what Justice Broussard wrote was, he said that that to simultaneously require you to afford insurance, you know, and steal your car if you don't, was just a little bit oppressive, and that he didn't see... He thought that at that point you'd have an arguable defense to any citation on the basis that you couldn't afford it, because they couldn't force you to buy something you couldn't afford to buy without also providing it for you.
And you pointed out that Broussard was a Duke Magian appointee after Rose Byrd.
No. He was. He came in before that. Broussard. Man, you want the short version, but you want me to fill in the long version information.
Well, we don't have to do that. I mean, I thought it was very interesting. You kind of you pointed out that there was a change in the makeup of the California Supreme Court in the 70s, which resulted in this decision that's saying upholding mandatory insurance, but
yeah,
providing an out as well. And you also quoted
so
from
it
the,
didn't provide an out. It was a dissenting opinion of Justice Broussard, signed on to by Justice Moss.
Oh, it was only a dissenting opinion. I see.
Right. Mandatory insurance was upheld because they took a very narrow view of it.
Mm-hmm.
But Rose Byrd was set to take that whole thing down, which is the reason she had to go away. Everybody believes that Rose Byrd went away because of her stand on the death penalty, and I believe that it was her stand against mandatory automobile liability insurance. That's the one thing they never talked about. It was the biggest single dollar item that they were dealing with at the time. And they had to make her go away, and they replaced her with a guy that came out of a guy's name is Malcolm Lucas, and he came out of a law firm in Long Beach, and he was a law partner with Duke Magian, and they worked for the insurance industry as lawyers in Long Beach. So he was a lawyer attorney coming in. And they stuck him in as Chief Justice to replace Rose Byrd. Then this case was called up immediately because there had been a hold put on that law. And they made the decision upholding it on its face and went to enforcing it again. And Broussard was trying to point out what was being done.
But in fact,
he pointed out how wrong it was, you know, how ill-founded and wrong.
But in fact, what's happened since is that the mandatory auto insurance has been upheld, and there's been,
They did that in 1994 with the State Streets Act of 1994 when they came in and declared driving was a privilege, not a right. And from that point on, the theft of your vehicle was set. They could steal your vehicle at any time, you know, for any one of a myriad of allegations, including no insurance. And this just short, it makes the distance between two points even shorter now, because the insurance industry can just cancel your registration, and then the cops can just pick up your car. That's it.
So, what kind of impact does this have on poor people in our county? It sounds to me like it has a significant impact.
They're going to be stealing cars at a phenomenal rate. You know, anybody that can't afford to have insurance is going to have the car stolen.
And this might have significant impact on homeless people who live in their vehicles.
Of course.
What about the argument that says, well, look, if you can't afford to insure your vehicle, if you can't afford to, you know, to pay your way, so to speak, and then why should we allow you to risk having you injure other people on the highway and then produce high medical bills for the rest of us to cover?
What, have you been taking drugs, man? What kind of a question is that?
Hey, it's an innocent question from an innocent talk show host.
Well, I don't know where somebody would come up with that kind of reasoning, but I guess with the mandatory liability insurance scheme, I guess it leads to that. Well, I don't know why anybody thinks they're protected by liability insurance anyway. Liability insurance is where I pick the insurance company that's going to protect you. How comfortable do you feel with that?
I have no idea, actually, never having been in that kind of an accident.
Well, it seems to me it would make more sense for you to pick the insurance company you wanted to protect yourself. And what I do or do not do has nothing to do with it. And then if you could afford to protect yourself, you'd have protection. And if you couldn't, you wouldn't. Just like with medical insurance or just like anything else, you know. If you're poor, you're poor. You know, but the way they've got it set up, the poor have got to figure out how to buy insurance to protect the rich. I mean, it's like, what the hell is that?
Well, it's a way of making sure the wrong sort of people aren't driving cars.
Yeah, that's the way it used to be over in Europe years ago before the Magna Carta. Yeah, if you had the money, you could ride the horse. Otherwise, you could just walk.
You know, yesterday on the Club Cruise taping, which I've mentioned already in the show, you and I were going to talk a bit about the situation at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center, where the sheriff's office and the Chamber of Commerce reigns supreme. And I know where you...
Chamber reigns supreme.
What? Chamber reigns supreme?
Oh, yeah. They are the quasi-unelected... government down there. They make all the decisions about the future of that community.
Well, I mean, I know that some of us feel that it was your exposure and then your lawsuit against Sheriff Mark Tracy, which, though it persuaded radio station KSCO to take you off the air for a year, nonetheless, it seemed to persuade Mark Tracy to turn in his resignation. Any comments on that?
That's an interesting way to phrase that, but okay.
And I know that you had some hopes for the new sheriff, Sheriff Robbins, and that last night on the Club Cruise show, which should be airing in a couple of weeks, which plays every Tuesday and Thursday, 7 o'clock, different shows, this will be one of them, you were rather, I got to say, vituperative in your attack on poor sheriffs Tracy and Robbins, not to mention our esteemed, tall, distinguished DA, Bob Lee.
Yeah.
So what exactly, I mean, first of all, give us the update on, well, you can either, rather than savage these public officials, so-called, why don't we start with the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center? I know that they have, taken some people at the Rancho, some merchants have taken a dim view of you, Jerry Henry, and others connected with your PAC, who have been hanging out near the Safeway, causing consternation with some of the shop owners. Can you give us the update?
Well, they're upsetting themselves. There's nobody outside their stores that are upsetting them. They're just doing it all for themselves. But well, they've been systematically just removing areas for the public to congregate down there. And only the ones willing to put up with the rudeness have stayed. You know, the average citizen has just, you know, moved along just like they were supposed to. They either, you know, they're either in the store spending money or they're home. I don't know. Otherwise, you know, two abreast, no talking, just keep their mouths shut. And the community is in real bad shape. It's about to lose the de facto
town square element of the area. So it's, you know, they've been relentless. They got all the time in the world, and they got all the money, and they just sit there and they just chew away at this stuff until they manage to destroy that village.
Well, I know I thought that you
and the people that live in it.
You'd actually won a victory by. They used to have a variety of signs up around the coffee roasting company: no smoking, no loitering.
13 signs in front of the coffee shop, and not one of them said welcome.
18 signs.
13
signs.
Yeah.
And now apparently most, if not all, those signs are gone.
They're all gone.
And I guess they also had a situation where they removed all their tables and chairs. They wouldn't allow.
Yeah, they did that years ago.
That was done years ago. And I guess
yeah.
You guys have pulled out your own tables and chairs every so often and set them up as a sort of a community resource.
Yeah, we brought them down there and provided them for the community. And of course, the shopping center just stole them.
Stole them?
Yeah.
You're not calling, the Aptos Coffee Roasting Company a thieving bunch of coffee merchants, are you?
Yeah, with the blessing of the sheriff's office.
Well, so did you file a report of stolen property with Sheriff Robin?
I did, but they wouldn't take the report.
They wouldn't take the report. Where does
well, no,
it,
because
sounds...
it, you know, it would go against what the will of the Chamber of Commerce. I told you, the Chamber runs that community down there.
Well, now, wait a minute. Sheriff Robbins, isn't this a new broom that was going to sweep clean?
He's done a lot of things on the surface that look pretty good, but there's some other stuff that he's doing that are real suspect.
Well, tell me about the good. The
quality of his deputies, I think, has stepped up quite a bit from when Mark was around. But Mark was Mark was just a jerk. But Robbins seems to have better deputies, but he still engages in a lot of this work that he has to do to keep these grants going that he sold out for, and some of that work is a little bit questionable in my eyes.
Well, I know that. I mean, this is jumping to a third subject, but why not? This is something.
No, this would be number five so far.
Number
Robert, I'm keeping track.
You're way ahead of me, but I mean, I'm. I guess I remember that, and you and I both finally saw that DVD of an old Club Crew show, which had you being interviewed talking about your assessment of the sheriff, it was then Sheriff Tracy's response to the federal raid on WAM,
yeah.
Women and Men's Medical Marijuana Collective, which was raided by the feds in 2002, and the sheriffs ended up, instead of, as you had hoped, arresting the federal officers and telling them to get the hell out of town until
the only thing he could do with the authority that he'd been given was arrest them.
You pointed out that the California Constitution specifically has a provision which states even if the feds come in, there's a conflict between federal and state law, the state police and authority is supposed to uphold state law unless there's a court order.
They have no choice but to uphold state law until there's a decision that says not to from an appellate court or higher.
And that decision when the WAM raid happened had not been...
Had not been made. No, that would have been the case that would have brought about that decision, by the way. But as it worked out, it didn't because Mark Tracy didn't do his job.
So now, do you think Robbins, if another such... Actually, I think WAM actually still does have farm going, although I've heard different stories about that, growing fields. If there was a second federal raid, as, who knows, maybe the case... what do you think Sheriff Robbins would do?
I have no idea. I do know that he takes a lot of pride in having busted out more pot cultivation farms, you know, more pot farms this year than ever before in the history of Santa Cruz. He brags about that a lot.
There was, in fact, a headline in the Sentinel a couple days ago about it.
That was apparently a supplier to the... the pot clubs, and I don't know how many pot clubs, and I don't know how many areas, but this guy was apparently a wholesaler to the pot clubs, and they busted him, made a big deal out of the fact that he had 100 pounds of pot, which is really nothing when you think about the amount of pot that's used by these medical marijuana clubs in a month, and $500,000, which again is nothing when you think about how much it costs to get 100 pounds of pot. So it's They're pretty proud about having busted an individual, you know, and this is the sheriff doing it in a county that voted very heavily in favor of medical marijuana.
Yeah, I'm looking
so
at...
He doesn't seem to have a lot of regard for the wishes of the voters.
I'm looking at the story in the yesterday's Sentinel. Deputies say major marijuana dealer busted. Six-month probe by the marijuana enforcement team led investigators to the door of Edwin Hoey, where they reported finding, as you said, 100 pounds of marijuana packaged to sell, more than $35,000 in cash, in addition to $500,000 stashed in a storage locker.
Which may or may not have been his money.
And, you know, I guess I thought, well, $500,000, that sounds like more than, would be legitimately recoverable if you were just paying for your expenses. But you kind of questioned me on that yesterday. You said, no, wait a minute. And can you run through the argument you had that $500,000, though it looks like a chunk of cash, may not be, in fact, a lot of money in this situation?
Well, no. I mean, at the very least, you know, if pot's going for, say that he was buying pot for $2,500 a pound, which would be an exceptionally good deal, to my understanding of the market, $500,000 would only buy 200 pounds. And 200 pounds is just not that much pot, depending on how many medical marijuana clubs that he's servicing.
And of course, we don't really know how much marijuana. There are only two marijuana clubs I know of in Santa Cruz.
Well, but he could very well be supporting clubs throughout the northern part of the state. You know, there's no reason why he couldn't be presumed to be doing that.
And
They didn't catch him selling the shit down there at the goddamn school grounds, okay?
I mean, you know, what I find interesting is, and I've talked about this on Free Radio, in the case of Roger Minch and the Hemporium up in Felton, this is a second prominent case where the county and the sheriffs, and it looks like the DA is going to be in on it too, are ignoring SB 420, Proposition 215.
Yeah, the Constitution of the state of California.
I mean,
the feds because they're drawing federal money.
They're claiming, and I don't know what the motivation is, but that could well be it. They're claiming that you cannot sell marijuana or give it away unless you are part of a closely knit kind of care provider collective. And if this were the case, then every day you would have illegal activity happening at Greenway in Harvey West. And
look, Robert, what sense does it make to provide access to people to medical marijuana and then arrest everybody that's going to provide it to them? You know, you sit there and you regulate the way that it can be provided to the point that it can't be.
Well,
and that's consistent with the wishes of the people that voted for Prop 215?
Well, if there's
some guy hanging around down to goddamn junior high school selling bags of pot to kids, cuff their fucking ass up and take them to jail.
Well,
leave them the hell
out. I agree with you, but what I find interesting here is that I've raised this issue with Attorney Ben Rice on the air on the one occasion he came on the air with me, and I invited him to come on again because he's also the attorney for Mr. Hoey, the fellow who was busted for the marijuana as well.
I call it Hoey because the whole thing's a bunch of Hoey.
It's a bunch of Hoey. But, you know, he is also the attorney for Roger Minch. But, I mean, he has pointed out that the argument in court that these DAs and the sheriffs are using is that any kind of sales of marijuana, unless it's in a collective situation to a care provider who also cultivates it, is illegal. And it's,
Robert,
wait a minute, hold it. Let me point out that this, as you point out, is opposed to not just Proposition 215, Proposition A, which we passed in 1992-93, but it also, you know, it seems to be opposed to the practices of clubs in our town and practices of clubs throughout the state.
Yes.
And my question to Ben Rice was, well, you know, don't we want to change this? Don't we want to get this damn thing changed? And he, you know, he keeps a pretty damn low profile for somebody who would want to be on the cutting edge of changing this. Obviously, the Board of Supervisors could change it tomorrow by stating, these are the guidelines. No, you do not have to cultivate your own marijuana. No, you do not have to. In other words, they could emphasize and make it clear for the county what the guidelines are. And I would assume that would have some more impact on the DAs and the sheriff's department. What do you think?
I think that there is a presumption of innocence that goes with all that activity, and it's protected by the Constitution, the state of California, post-Prop 215. That is being ignored by the bureaucrats, who are getting federal money by way of grants and have sold out to the federal perspective and in turn just betrayed the people of this county. They made it real clear to polls what they think about medical marijuana, use, access, all that stuff. They didn't make a rule that says, yes, it's okay to have that, to have the administrators come in and administer away the ability to get it. You know, the two just don't work.
Well, we do have a problem in terms of taking it to court because, as you know, the California Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has not been sympathetic to arguments, at least some of the arguments presented, that Proposition 215 can override federal controlled substances. But we aren't even.
If the feds were in there doing this crap, we'd probably have a big fight on our hands. But why are we having this fight with state?
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly. And my question then is, what can we do locally to stop this? It's a big question, of course.
No, it's an easy one.
Go for it.
He's been so proud of his efforts in those regards. Maybe it's time to recall Sheriff Robin.
And what about D.A. Bob Lee?
Why don't we start with the guy that does the most bragging about it? I've been reading about this guy all goddamn year long, about how proud he is of busting up marijuana this and marijuana that. He's acting against the will of the people in this county, and maybe it's time to just, you know, recall it.
Now, have you tried? I know we tried to recall Danner in the mid '90s and didn't get enough signatures, though there was a robust campaign. You think this could succeed?
I don't think that there's ever been a proposition on a state ballot that has ever had the support of as many voters in a county as Prop 215 had in Santa Cruz County.
And it may be that the very effort to recall Robbins might have a salutary effect on his policies.
Also.
We're talking with Richard Quigley. Richard, I have another guest coming on at 7. I'm going to be doing some preparation shortly, but we have a few more minutes. Are there some subjects you want to cover that you think we haven't covered or some aspects of what we have covered that you think should be more fleshed out or emphasized?
No, I think we're okay.
Now, if people want to hear your own radio broadcasts, they are still being archived.
No.
They're not being archived.
Nah, I just do my show and go home.
Bummer.
Yeah, well.
Well, this show is being archived, for those of you who want to hear it again, at www.huffsantacruz.org. So we've got you here, Richard.
Yeah, I don't do that much anymore, and it mostly has to do with the amount of energy it takes to do it. And in my present condition, I just don't have a lot of energy to do anything anymore, so...
Well, you can be found, however, on the Sentinel Forums website.
I do show up there from time to time.
And you will, of course, be available for a show or two on Club Cruise, denouncing bureaucrats and other ne'er-do-wells.
Need to do some more of those right away.
Well, listen, Richard, I really appreciate you coming on the air, and I'm going to probably try to coax you on this show again as well as try to get some more Club Cruise spots open for you, though. That's not my call.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for coming on. If anybody wants to check out your website, they should Google for Richard Quigley.
Yeah, that'll do it. And have Becky call me.
I'll try to do that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, good night.
Good night. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. You can give a call if you've got any comments or additions, subtractions, news, breaking, anything that you've got for here that might be relevant. We've been talking a lot about medical marijuana, harassment of marijuana users. I think what I'll do is play the last part of that interview with Michael Wallace, the homeless man who was busted for marijuana. There's not much more of it. And then we're going to go into preparation for the guest who's coming on at 7 o'clock. His name is Jeffrey Afghani, and he has written about the situation of homeless people in Skid Row, given the court decision and some of the political machinations down there as the police chief and the city council and the mayor try to thwart the federal court's ruling that, yes, you can sleep at night if you're homeless. Sorry, Mr. Merchant Combine.
You keep repeating that in a polite tone of voice. And there are many ways police try to get around this. And Katya gave this very educational seminar showing how police try to get you to start talking and try to persuade you or intimidate you. But actually, if you know your rights, they're somewhat limited in what they can do. Of course, with the expansion of police powers, and you know, both locally and federally, you get a grim shadow is cast over our fair land.
Absolutely. Like I say, I just felt like I was at the wrong place at the wrong time, and I usually don't leave anything to chance, but...
Well, you had a right to be where you were, I imagine.
It's simply
you
got to be somewhere.
Got to be somewhere. No, no. If you're homeless, you have a right to be nowhere.
Absolutely.
There you are. And how's Santa Cruz treating you?
Santa Cruz is a great place. I regret having gone over to San Jose that night.
So have you gotten better treatment from the Santa Cruz Police Department?
I believe so. I think they're a little more conscious about such things.
Well, Santa Cruz does have marijuana enforcement as the lowest priority, provided you are not in a public place, provided you are over the age of 21, going to be a third provision. They're not supposed to be going after you unless they have nothing else to do. Of course, you know, with all those Homeland Security grants, there's just so much time on your hands. You know, what can you do?
What can you do?
We've been talking with
Michael Wells.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, sir.
And indeed, there is an actual article on Santa Cruz City Council and the Santa Cruz Police Department's receipt of Homeland Security grants in the good times. This that came out today, it's not a very extensive one, it's not very well documented, but at least raises the issue. I've been asking these questions at Santa Cruz City Council repeatedly and getting no answers, even from that great outgoing Green Party guru, Tim Fitzmaurice, and I'm likely to get even less in terms of any kind of information from the Rotkin Matthews Riley Council. Maybe we'll call it the Riley Robinson Council. Who knows? Again, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Coming up at 7 o'clock, an interview with Jeffrey Afghani, who has written an article, Guilty of Being Homeless in America, Sleepless on Skid Row. I'm going to do a little background on this before he comes on so we can kind of move forward. I've talked about this Jones decision at length. Jones and a number of other homeless defendants were taken on as clients by the ACLU when they were repeatedly arrested in Los Angeles, Skid Row area, for sleeping under a very draconian law that said you can't sleep, sit, or lie anywhere on a sidewalk in Los Angeles. And the ACLU attempted, I believe, to simply get an injunction allowing them to sleep on the sidewalk since they had no place else to go between the hours of, I think it was 9 to 6:30 or 9:30 to 6. And that was upheld. That was upheld by the Los Angeles Federal Court of Appeals after the judge originally threw it out. A federal judge threw it out, and then the Los Angeles Court of Appeals said, nope, it's cruel and unusual punishment if any such law on its face, if there's no shelter space, or just the very nature of the law, given the situation in Los Angeles, is unconstitutional, is a violation of the Eighth Amendment of the federal Constitution, cruel and unusual punishment. Well, this upset the Los Angeles merchants and city council and politicians, and they came up with a compromise, which the city attorney and the mayor and the police chief came up with a proposal with the ACLU. They all kind of put their heads together and said, well, how about this? We'll suspend this lawsuit. It won't go any further, and we'll abandon it if you agree to, you know, only enforce this law during the day or at least not to enforce it at night. The city council refused to do that in a vote in September, but the city attorney on his own initiative, what he actually did was he said, it's okay to arrest people during the day. He didn't really say, don't arrest them at night. He said, do arrest them during the day. I put it in a more positive light, but it looks like he may have said, and we're going to get some more updating from Mr. Afghani when he gets on the air here shortly, assuming he calls in. It looks like that what happened down in L.A. after this decision, and it's still being appealed. It was appealed by the city council when it came down, and it was supposed to go up to a higher panel, but then that appeal was stalled because the city council
and the ACLU wanted to work out some kind of a deal, and apparently they're still in the back room babbling about it. I called the ACLU today, both in Los Angeles and here in Santa Cruz. There's a big office of the ACLU in Santa Cruz. The Drug Policy Group is here, which is, it's kind of ironic. They aren't concerned in the least about drug problems of people in Santa Cruz jails, but they're big on some national cases. And they are concerned about the WHAM situation, to their credit. But they didn't have any information on the Jones case, and I'm hoping I can get some more. And on Sunday, I'll be back with more information about that. But there are the issue that's come up, of course, and we've learned since, that there's been massive increase of harassment of homeless people using other laws in the sleeping ban, and I believe also possibly using this sleeping ban law, even though the federal court has said, no, you can't do it. So I'm going to read a few articles. I'm going to try to read a little of Jeffrey's article because it's a long one. If you want to read the whole article by Jeffrey Afghani, you should go to the Counterpunch website, www.counterpunch.org, and then use the search engine for Jeffrey Afghani. It's like as an Afghani citizen, but that's actually his last name. The name of the article is "Guilty of Being Homeless in America: Sleepless on Skid Row." Here's a couple of articles around that issue before we get to his article. L.A. City's Council's Skid Row Reversal Does Nothing for the Homeless. And this is I believe it's an ACLU, on the ACLU website. Despite the Los Angeles City Council's September 20th decision to reject a hard-fought compromise designed as a first step toward providing true help for downtown's homeless population, and I'm going to interrupt this right now to say I think Afghani has a really clear view on this. All this constant talk about helping the homeless has absolutely nothing to do with helping the homeless, but actually has to do with clearing them out of the area so more profitable businesses can move in. That's really the agenda. It's always been the agenda. And to pretend it isn't the agenda is to go contrary to reality and also to do disservice to everyone involved, even if you're in favor of that agenda. I know, you know, it's not, we want to look at these issues straight on, because even if you're a gentrification guy, you know, let's talk about the issue clearly. I know it doesn't sound as nice in middle class ears, but if you actually want to get rid of homeless people in an area, you might consider such things as providing some single room occupancy elsewhere. You might think about things of providing employment opportunities. You might think about housing as a reality, not just sort of bogus 10-year plans that involve simply creaming, you know, a small amount of help for some of homeless people, a vast amount of jobs for middle class Social Security or, you know, social service bureaucrats, but rather dealing with, you know, the essential needs like emergency shelter, which in Santa Cruz is needed tonight. There's a room tonight in the Armory and the church program for 160 of Santa Cruz's 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people, not Santa Cruz County, Santa Cruz City. The county is more like 8,000 to 10,000, and it's probably more than that, actually. And you have people who are just, you know, they're trying to survive in vehicles, they're trying to survive outside. And even if you want to gentrify an area, I mean, recognize when you squeeze the balloon in one place, it's going to show up somewhere else. And that's what Los Angeles, of course, is finding. Despite the Los Angeles City Council's September 20th decision to reject a hard-fought compromise designed as a first step toward providing true help for downtown's homeless population, the ACLU of Southern California's efforts to advocate on behalf of this vulnerable population continue, is the ACLU, of course. This spring, the ACLU of Southern California won a historic victory for homeless rights when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in Jones versus City of Los Angeles that the city's anti-homeless ordinance was unconstitutional and that arresting homeless people lying, sitting, or sleeping on the sidewalk when no shelter space is available was cruel and unusual punishment. Under the guidance of a court mediator, ACLU of Southern California staff worked with the offices of Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, LAPD Chief William Bratton, and City Attorney Rocky Delgadillo to reach a compromise. We have a caller, and I think that is our caller. Let's see if we actually, that is our man, our guest. Hi, I hope you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes, is this Robert?
Yes, is this Jeffrey?
This is Greg.
I'm sorry, it's Greg Afghani.
That's correct.
I've been miscalling you, Greg. I apologize.
That's okay. Not a problem at all.
I've referred people to your article on Counterpunch, and I've got it here in the studio, and I've gone through it. I haven't read it aloud. It's really I like it. It's a great article. And I've read your emails, but why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself. You're a writer?
Yeah, I'm a writer, and I'm actually educated as an attorney, and I'm not currently practicing because I work in the corporate environment in management, but yeah, I have a background in law, and I'm educated as a lawyer, and involved in many different social causes and activism wherever I can.
And are you a resident of the downtown Los Angeles area?
No, actually, I've grown up in Southern California. To be honest, I grew up in Orange County, which is an adjacent county just to the south of Los Angeles County. But I'm pretty familiar with Los Angeles County. I'm pretty familiar with the downtown area, and definitely familiar with the regional politics.
Well, your article, Guilty of Being Homeless in America, Sleepless on Skid Row, which is dated October 11th, begins by talking about Robert Lee Puri. Is that his name?
Yeah, so Robert Lee Puri is an individual who lives on Skid Row.
And you begin the section by saying he's a sleep criminal guilty of being homeless.
Basically, the essence of the article is to just bring to attention the stark disparity between people with power and people without power. And I think especially when you're talking in terms of the situation that homeless folks face, whether it be in Los Angeles or in San Francisco or San Diego or whatever other metropolitan area in the United States, it really boils down to a situation of power, and it's a struggle for power and recognition. We live in some really perilous times right now where notions such as being a citizen or having entitlement to certain constitutional rights are really a concept that are not really readily recognized by those in power. And we live in a very a time where a lot of stark contrast can be seen, and it's pretty instructive if you pay attention.
You begin the article by saying that he lived on Skid Row and presumably still lives there, Robert Puri, in a long, a decrepit and neglected area of downtown Los Angeles, home to the largest contingent of homeless people in the western United States, including Robert, for the last four decades, where he sleeps on the streets because he cannot afford a room in a single-room occupancy hotel and is often unable to find an open bed in a shelter. You did independent research. You took this from the court briefs.
Oh, this is interesting. This is actually from the article written by Richard Winton, an author who, in this article, I quote very very often. Mr. Winton and Kara DeMazia of Los Angeles Times have kind of taken the horse by the reins, so to speak, and they've positioned themselves as the resident journalist for this topic. And it's really interesting to see from their perspective how they view the homeless situation, especially in Skid Row and in a general sense, Los Angeles. And as we get going in our discussion, I'll kind of shed some light on what their perspective is and where it comes from, just based on the wording of their own writing.
And how many people are on Skid Row who you or they would estimate are homeless?
Well, the estimates vary, but anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 people in a 50-block radius, which is known as Skid Row loosely, but it's actually referred to as Central City East is the actual terminology used for the area.
And I think I saw in a Japanese newspaper it's also part of Japantown or something? Or?
Well, Koreatown is a local community that borders one side of Skid Row, and it's a subset of some of the community there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's large contingents of homeless from throughout the western United States that go there. And so what's been created there, and it's what's gone on for decades, is that a lot of homeless individuals from all over the country kind of are living in that area, and mostly because they have no other choice, to be frank with you.
Now, in San Francisco, which you probably visited, you may notice south of Market, there still are lots of single-room occupancy hotels. Is that the case in Skid Row?
Actually, no. That's a great point that you're bringing up. The availability of affordable housing all the way to single-room occupancy hotels has actually steadily declined in the Skid Row area, and that is really the overarching emphasis of of the story here with regards to this sleep ban that you and I have been contacting each other on, and that is that my argument has been, since beginning this analysis, that the sleep ban is designed to remove folks from a particular area, and that's why the city of Los Angeles adopted this sleep ban. They want to remove homeless individuals from this area for one reason and primarily one reason only, and that is to make way for large business interests. There's no rocket science behind it. It's a fairly simple case of a very draconian economics here.
Again, continuing the your description of Puri, actually quoting Richard Winton of the L.A. Times in his article, Plan Would End Homeless Tent Cities. Robert was cited twice by LAPD for the heinous act of sleeping on the sidewalk before he was arrested by police officers in 2003. City of LA, recognizing Skid Row as a magnet for outdoor enthusiasts, enacted an anti-camping ordinance criminalizing the act of sitting, lying, or sleeping on public sidewalks. Do you know how old that ordinance is?
I think the ordinance is about 4 or 5 years old, and I could be incorrect about that. Of course, the more important than the age of the ordinance, Robert, is the fact that the ordinance is becoming now under the spotlight, not only from our perspective as activists, because of the fact that it violates people's constitutional rights, American citizens' constitutional rights, but from business interests' perspective, because the ordinance was backed by these major cartels of business organizations precisely for a legal means to conduct class cleansing in that area. And as we get into this, I've got some updates with regards to this story where it kind of lays out how they've planned this out and how they've been able to put their plan into effect to virtually wipe out the homeless population in Skid Row to make way for what they call big plans for downtown Los Angeles.
Now, historically, do you have any, have you looked into or read people who've written accounts of the discussion at City Council before this rather draconian and sweeping ordinance was passed that banned sitting, lying, or sleeping on it's any public sidewalk in Los Angeles, right?
Right. So the Los Angeles Municipal Code applies to anywhere in Los Angeles, any public sidewalk in Los Angeles. And it's interesting that you bring up that point because it's a very great point. And that is that though it applies to any sidewalk or public area that would encompass the code in the city of Los Angeles, the focus here is really on Skid Row. And that's not coming from me to try to drive the point home to you and your listeners. The point is really coming from the business community and the local media, who almost exclusively focuses in on Skid Row, and with good reason, because that's exactly where the developers are looking to build their high-rise buildings and condominiums.
Now, do we have independent information about that in the sense that you have suddenly seen new specific plans by specific developers? Previously, they weren't that interested in this area, but now they are. I like the flavor of your argument. I'm sympathetic to it. I'm an old lefty, too. But I also wonder, do we have the empirical evidence that indicates this, particularly in this situation here?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I was thinking about going through it chronologically, but let's go ahead and do that. Let me skip right to that for you.
And then go back to the chronological, because I'm interested in that, too.
Absolutely. So today's date is what, the 15th or the 14th?
Yeah, today is the 14th.
So I have in front of me the Los Angeles Times headline of the front page for Wednesday, December 13th. The biggest story is mega projects could reshape L.A. growth. Work is underway on the L.A. Live development near Staples Center, which is right adjacent to Skid Row. Plans include the convention center, a hotel, a live theater, cinema, restaurants, and clubs, as well as luxury condominiums. And the writer, of course, Kara Demacia, who works with Richard Winton and has teamed up with him on all these on these articles about the homeless folks in Skid Row, starts off the article by simply saying, Los Angeles is having a city-building moment. Two massive projects, the L.A. Live Entertainment Complex, which is in downtown, the area of our discussion, and the Grand Avenue development on Bunker Hill, which is several blocks away. So she goes on by saying the projects are a combined cost of $7.5 billion what the developers are putting in to this. And of course, she skirts the issue of what the effect will be on the local population. That's not addressed here because the essence of the article was to talk about the big plans in place. And these big plans, they have a name for it, although the effects are that homeless people are swept away, and that's using the term kindly. They're harassed, they're criminalized, their personal property is stolen, they're incapacitated, they're incarcerated, they're cited routinely for what are called quality of life violations, and this is, we have a name for this. This is what Kara Demacia calls smart growth, and those are the plans underway. They have a plan for 2,900 condominium homes in the area. So this is just yesterday's newspaper, and it goes directly to the area that's been talked about. I don't think it's any mistake or coincidence that all this focus suddenly on the Skid Row area, which has had a chronic homeless population and homeless problem for over three decades, is suddenly in the forefront and now needs to be resolved immediately, because these folks know that they're who their masters are. They realize that obviously big business is calling for this. It's calling for the sweeping up of this area, and the only impediment in the way is really the Constitution, and that's an obstacle that can be overcome rather easily.
Well, the Constitution, as we know, since October 17th, Military Commissions Act, we're all enemy combatants here.
Yeah. Well, to further that, Robert, today, A circuit court held, a circuit court judge held that the Military Commissions Act with respect to detaining non-citizens indefinitely is actually upheld. So many attorneys, including myself, were of the opinion that this Military Commissions Act, although draconian and reversal of habeas corpus and 800 years of Western jurisprudence, would soon be abolished or struck down. The first foray has been that it's been upheld, but that's, of course, not what we're here to talk about.
Oh, right. Although, of course, it ties in. I know I was last in Los Angeles, in 2000 during the Democratic Convention, which was held in the Staples Convention Center, I believe.
Right. Sure.
And there was massive police militarized attacks on us. My coworker and former producer of this show, Becky Johnson, actually won a settlement when she was attacked by the police department when she was trying to video what went down. And at that time, as I remember vaguely, the ACLU had some other lawsuit going prior to the Jones case, which was in 2003. The Democratic Convention was in 2000. There was some ruling that police could not arrest people on the streets of Skid Row under some other court ruling. Do you recall that ruling?
No, I don't recall the name or the holding in that ruling, but I'm gonna surmise by saying that I believe that ruling was in regards to folks, American citizens who were engaged in the act of a protest or with some kind of public grievance, and the court tangentially hit that by upholding the right of folks to mass together to air their grievances publicly. I think since then, though, with those zoning laws that were put into effect with the Democratic Convention for John Kerry, they pretty much rescinded that holding by saying that folks could accumulate together and publicly grieve as long as it was done in certain areas, and then they put very restrictive and draconian measures in place whereby you can be a protester but nowhere near the thing you're protesting.
Okay, because I'm going to do a little research while you're discussing some of this to see if I can find that ruling, because I know there is also some discussion in early stories about Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's Villaraigosa.
Villaraigosa, thank you. That he was, he uses all this soft talk about finding solutions for the homeless and housing, and you bring this up in your article on the Counterpunch website, that, you know, this is... It sounds like the good cop, bad cop routine to me, to a certain extent. You know that.
Well, you're absolutely right, but I mean, if you really look at it, it's no more. It's across the board, Robert. It's the same thing that every politician does to get into office. They tap into people's emotive reflexes with regards to what our natural instinct is, absent propaganda and misinformation, which is to act in solidarity and to have empathy and sympathy for other people, other beings of our species. So So he goes and politicizes and runs for office under the guise of helping the homeless, and specifically actually talks about helping the homeless in downtown and providing social services. And it's funny, again, another excellent point for you to bring up, Villaraigosa, because again, in the same paper, the Los Angeles Times, just yesterday, there was an article talking about how he traveled from Los Angeles. Now, if you've been there, you're familiar, from downtown Los Angeles, where his office is, up to Bel Air, which is one of the most wealthy areas of Los Angeles, to visit a Jewish temple to basically beg for citizen support of the homeless problem in downtown Los Angeles, rather than to use his power as the mayor to appropriate and push for appropriation of city funds to help the homeless. So I guess this is what he meant when he said that the downtown homeless were his top mayoral priority.
Going back to your article from Counterpunch, which I think not only is of interest for throwing some new light on it and giving a very critical analysis of, well, an interesting analysis of how the LA Times ties in its reporting and its propagandizing, essentially on behalf of the LAPD and the mayor's office and the city council. Maybe what you should do is give us a little a thumbnail history. I've given it myself. Maybe you can give me your perspective on what's happened between April and now after the court made its decision, its 2-1 decision about, you can't arrest someone for sleeping.
Sure.
Now,
sure.
Was that decision you can't arrest someone for sleeping if there's no shelter available, or was it simply whether there's shelter available or not, this law is unconstitutional? Let me, Claire, ask you that question first.
Sure, absolutely. So the presiding judge, the judge who wrote the opinion for the case, Kim Wardlow, in her analysis, she basically said that this municipal code, the sleep ban of Los Angeles, is one of the most restrictive bans on personal movement across the United States. And I think I have that quoted exactly somewhere in the article, but she basically announced it that way, and she held that it was unconstitutional in a 2-1 decision on a 3-court panel, mostly because the fact that it was restrictive as to the movement of free peoples to sit, stand where they wish on public property, and then use the reasoning that, although other cities have enacted ordinances similar, although not as restrictive as the one in Los Angeles, those cities have also, at the same time or commensurate to that, put into place social services that would have an effect on the homeless populations of their constituency. So whereas Los Angeles, she cited, has a chronic and continuous problem with the homeless folks not receiving adequate social services. So in the case, she cited several different statistics that showed that not only was the homeless population in Los Angeles not being taken care of with adequate social services, but that the situation was getting worse at a clip of 10% annually increase in homeless a population in Los Angeles, and that the city wasn't doing what it could to afford shelters and other social services. So at a time when the city is either reducing or keeping stagnant its support of its constituents in the way of homeless people, they can't at the same time try to adopt a draconian and very restrictive public movement code.
So is the short answer that, I mean, we know that in Miami, the federal judge, Clyde Wilkins, anyway, he found that you couldn't arrest homeless people without providing them an alternate shelter bed. In fact, a police officer could not approach a homeless person for a life-sustaining misdemeanor such as camping or
right.
a fire or indecent exposure if you're trying to, bathe yourself, unless
exactly.
you can say to the person, here, we can take you to a shelter, and if you don't come, we're going to arrest you for violating, various laws against camping and so forth. Was a similar conclusion reached here, or was a more sweeping conclusion reached that, no, this law is unconstitutional, we throw it out, find something else?
No, it was a similar conclusion, that as long as it is the case that the city is not providing adequate social services in the way of shelter beds, and not providing social services for rehabilitation and or treatment, as long as that was the case and the number of homeless people exceeded the number of available shelter beds, then this type of code would be unconstitutional. It would be cruel and unusual punishment to arrest people, and I think the exact wording was, for being in a situation for which they had no other choice.
Right. Now, I, by the way, I found the ACLU lawsuit case from 2000. There was a judge's decision here. Judge Lourdes G. Baird issued a tentative order in the case of Justin et al. Versus City of L.A. involving the harassment of homeless people in the downtown Skid Row area. 23 homeless individuals said police had engaged in a widespread practice of harassment. The order by Judge Baird barred the city and police from engaging in, one, stopping the homeless without reasonable suspicion while they're simply standing or walking on public streets and sidewalks and not obstructing such streets or sidewalks, two, demanding production of identification or on threat of arrest and arresting individuals if no ID is procured, three, searching the possessions of those homeless without reasonable suspicion, four, ordering the homeless to move along from where they are standing lest they are obstructing or blocking free passage, five, confiscating personal property when it has not been abandoned and destroyed, and six, issuing citations for loitering. And I guess the difference here is this has nothing to do with sleeping or lying or sitting. Does this mean that prior to the court decision in April, the Jones decision, it was legal to, quote, loiter and stand in Skid Row but not to sit or sleep or lie?
I suppose that's a view that can be taken.
Right.
But all those instances that you talked about, the harassment, the theft of personal property, the using municipal codes as a guise for moving people out of an area, we have a term for this. These are the things that William Bratton, the chief of Los Angeles Police Department, refers to as the fight against crime and cleaning up.
Or perhaps the war on terror, huh?
Oh, well, you can choose your euphemism, but he was very explicit in saying that, and I think my article detailed exactly what his thoughts were. He was very, you know, and the great thing about our society, despite the fact that there's so many terrible things that we can talk about, is the fact that when you do an analysis of a stark difference in power, the folks that are in power are pretty upfront and pretty abrasive with exactly what they mean when they say what they're trying to accomplish. And Bratton was that way in the analysis and the research I did for the article. And he's very clear. Either he's very clear or he doesn't have the qualifications to be chief of police because, he believes that he's in a fight against crime, by arresting sleeping homeless people. So either he has a misperception of what crime is because once the court has a holding that says you cannot arrest people for sitting, lying, or sleeping, that is the law. So it's actually, it's kind of ironic that what his police officers are doing are actually committing the crime by harassing and or arresting people for doing what the court said that they were constitutionally entitled to do.
Well, maybe he needs to arrest his own officers.
That was my point exactly in the article, was that, you know, and none of the reporters for the Los Angeles Times or KCAL 9 News took the opportunity at the hastily arranged press conference with William Bratton and Mayor Villaraigosa to question that analysis. How is it a fight against crime, or who does it, or more succinctly, who does it protect to arrest sleeping homeless people? I mean, it's a logical question to ask, and yet you have a cadre of reporters, and none of them ask the very logical and visible question.
We have the same problem in Santa Cruz with reporters like Shanna McCord of the Santa Cruz Sentinel and others who are, you know, they're when proposed reforms of the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz come up, we hear things like child molesters will be sleeping in vehicles, crime in the neighborhoods will increase, defecation, urination, littering, loitering. People will not be able to walk the streets safely and so forth. What's your reaction to these? I know what my reaction is, but what's your reaction to these kinds of charges?
You know, it's predictable that journalists would behave that way, though it's deplorable. We have to remember that these journalists, although we want to think the best of them, they are working for large corporate interests. They work for large, an increasingly corporatized media and increasingly concentrated media who are beholden to their advertisers, and their advertisers have what we like to refer to in neoliberal terms as diversified portfolios. In other words, many of these advertisers, these large corporations, have investments in many different business interests, and many of them happen to be in the Los Angeles area, also invested in the $7.5 billion project. And so when you talk about a boardroom that's making decisions as to what's going to be news and what's not going to be news, or for that matter, how that news is going to be portrayed, you would be foolish or naive to think that a $7.5 billion project put forth by the folks who are your customers, who are the advertisers, is not going to bring with it a certain point of view that has to be espoused. And it's pretty predictable that you have individuals like the lady that you mentioned there in Northern California, and folks like Richard Witten and Kara DeMasia here in the Los Angeles Times, who view things very acutely and very much from a certain perspective. And I was hoping that in our discussion tonight, when I gave you the updates with what's happened since that, the city council declined to uphold the compromise, how that's unfolded and how the city has gone into, immediate class cleansing mode, and why they've done it, how they've done it, and how successful they've been at doing it.
Well, let's do that. We're talking with Greg Afghani, who's a writer in LA as well as a, non-practicing lawyer, would that be the right way of putting it?
Sure.
And do you wish to reveal, full disclosure, your corporate connections yourself? Or?
Actually, I'd rather not. I would say that in order for me to continue in my activism and in order for me to be effective, I can't do that. But I can say I have absolutely no conflict of interest in anything that we're discussing. The market that I'm in is in technology and has absolutely no investment or no connection in any way to the happenings of what I'm discussing.
Nor are you a secret Al-Qaeda operative trying to spread terror and chaos in the L.A. area.
Yeah, if that's what Al-Qaeda is trying to do, then no, I'm not. I'm not involved in that.
Gotcha. Well, I want to hear what you have to say, but I want to quickly just kind of because I think you put it so well in your article, continue with this with Robert Puri's case, because we have to understand that this, we're talking in generalities, when we talk about homeless people, sleeping bans, mm-hmm. you know, gentrification, millions of dollars mm-hmm. in development. But when we're talking about a particular individual man, I think you put this very well when you say, for Robert's act of sidewalk sleep crime, the unquestionably honorable judge in this case, you're speaking sarcastically, meted out a sentence of, ironically, one night in jail, mercifully suspending the remaining 12 months, then compounding the irony with insult, dutifully imposing a fine of $195 in restitution and attorney's fees on a man who, lest we forget, can't afford a single night's stay in a downtown hotel slum. Obviously, this jurist has a keen sense of justice and heartfelt compassion, no doubt to ensure that Robert understood the seriousness of his indiscretion. LA's finest dispensed yet more callousness, discarding the tools of Robert's criminal enterprise, his blankets, cooking utensils, and tent. So this is back in 2003, perhaps, or that's when the suit was filed. Probably the actual incidents were prior to that, I imagine.
Yes.
But again, let's go forward and give you a chance to do what you suggest you want to do, which I think would be useful for us to know. What's happened since April? Give us a blow by blow. What since this decision came down? And I'm gonna ask you one question before that, and that is, and I've tried to get the answer to this all day, and maybe you know it. Currently, there's settlement discussions going on between the ACLU and the city on this issue, right?
Well, the settlement discussions were scuttled as a result of the Los Angeles City Council's vote. In effect, the mayor and the police chief and the ACLU had come to a so-called compromise, which of course I'm critical of, but you know, in all essence, is better than the status quo. Coming to an agreement with regards to allowing homeless folks to sleep between the hours of 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. without interference from police, and then close up their encampments thereafter and abide by the anti-camping ordinance during the hours of between 6 a.m. and 9 p.m.
I understand this. I understand this was scuttled. I got, and it actually raises another question. But what I want to know is, I've understood by reading other articles that there is still some kind of settlement discussion going on, which has resulted in the cases being put on hold in terms of it's going to a higher panel, an en banc review by the Court of Appeals. Is that
yes,
true or not?
That's absolutely true. What's happened is that the city attorney, Rocky Delgadillo's office, has looked and combed through the decision, and in reviewing the decision, apparently has given some counsel that it would be best for the city at this point to see if they can come to a settlement again with the ACLU and get it to pass the LA City Council, and maybe another try at a vote, rather than take their chances on an appeal if the finding of the court in the 2-1 decision has merit, which I believe that it does, and that it is a cruel and unusual punishment to arrest people for sitting, lying, and sleeping on the sidewalk. So they're kind of hedging their bets, Robert, is what's happening. They're saying, let's go into discussions, let's see if we can work this out, because, of course, business interest is chomping at the teeth, and they want to break ground on these developments, and they already have, and they want to get a settlement in place. However, they want one that's, absolutely favored to their ends.
Now,
so if they can do that, then they're going to, and if not, then the appeal is their contingency.
My interest in Santa Cruz is we have a similar sleeping ban, actually in some ways more draconian, in some ways less. Our sleeping ban does allow you to sleep during the day, but not at night. So it sounds like it's, in its own way equally offensive, although not, I guess the LA ban banned everything, day and night on sidewalks.
Right.
This bans all sleeping after 11 o'clock at night until 8:30 in the morning on public property, even in your own vehicle, even legally parked, and on most private property as well. And so it's an interesting expansion. And so my question as I look at this decision is, let's suppose the ACLU and the city do settle on this, which would stop the appeal. Would this still be binding precedent for us up here, or would it be depublished?
It absolutely would be depublished, and that was the key to my analysis as to why the so-called compromise is not really a compromise, because in order for the ACLU to win its battle here, it seems as if they were willing to lose the war everywhere else. That's my analysis, and that is that it was a known agreement as part of the compromise that that if voted through by the LA City Council, which may still happen in another effort, if this were to go through, the court would voluntarily remove the case from record, thereby making it unavailable to be used as precedent.
Well, I guess the only circumstances under which advocates like you and me would agree with this is if we looked at the en banc panel and thought we were dead ducks with this decision. What's your view about the probable outcome of this if it goes to a larger panel?
The view would be this, and I really don't want to appear too jaded, but my view of it is this, based on what I've seen. My view of it is that, depending on the judges on the en banc panel, they would look at any kind of agreement that the city of Los Angeles would make in order to recognize the ills that came forth in Kim Wardlow's decision. So, more succinctly, if the city of Los Angeles agreed to set aside, quote, affordable housing in that area, agreed to correctly or adequately fund certain social services, agreed to take measures such as these, I believe that the court, in that instance, if they believe that the city of Los Angeles would do that, then they would fine for the city of Los Angeles and allow the sleep ban to stand. If the court's persuasion, depending on ideology, was that this is just a simple constitutional matter, which is what I and the ACLU, and I would surmise to guess that you would agree, looks at it as a simple constitutional argument as to whether the government can enact legislation that says that free citizens are not allowed to sit, stand, or lie on public property is constitutional or not. An arrest for that is a cruel and unusual punishment.
So I guess the next question is, what's the time factor here? How long will there be is the ACLU agreed to stall this whole thing? Can this settlement babble go on forever?
No, I would imagine. I would imagine the ACLU is willing to go on as long as it takes to get a favorable judgment for the homeless individuals. But at the same time, there is a lot of pressure to bear coming from the business development interests, because they want to break ground on what yesterday's headline said are mega projects reshaping Los Angeles's growth. So they want the most favorable settlement that they can get, but they also want it as quickly as possible.
Now let's go back to the chronology that you were talking about and the developments that have happened. First, briefly, between April and September, when this decision came down in April, did the police stop enforcing these laws, or did they step up their enforcement, or did they continue between April and September when this compromise came to the city council saying, okay, depublish the decision, we'll let you sleep on the sidewalks during the nighttime, 10 feet away from residences and businesses, provided you strike your tents and such during the day?
So let me give you the timeline rather quickly.
Go for it.
So the court comes down with the finding, which was a surprise to the city government and to a lot of business interests that threw them for a loop, just clearly stating that you cannot do that. That's unconstitutional, and it's cruel and unusual punishment. So if you believe the Los Angeles Police Department, their point of view is that it stymied their effort to, quote, fight crime. So they were stymied in their effort to stop homeless people from sleeping. So the Los Angeles Police Department's perspective is that it did encroach on their ability to carry out their charge. If you ask the homeless citizens of Skid Row, which the Los Angeles County Action Network has said that has faced harassment and criminalization from the Los Angeles Police Department before and after that law was enacted, they will tell you that the police continued to harass them, although maybe not as explicitly as they did before the court's finding, but the police harassment continued throughout. So,
using the same law or using other means?
No, using other means. More succinctly, drug arrests or probable cause to believe something is happening, and the person that they're viewing as a suspect is the one who did it. There's so many means that the police have at their disposal to violate folks' constitutional rights, especially those who don't have the kind of wealth to hire attorneys of the caliber that the ACLU provides. So,
gotcha.
So to keep it brief, the court finds for this. Let's just assume the LAPD is being honest for once in the history of Los Angeles, and they actually have reduced the number of harassments and enforcing the suit. The court orders the ACLU and the Los Angeles Police Department, the mayor's office, to get together to, quote, settle their differences. And those differences are basically to hammer out an agreement that would satisfy business interests and at the same time minimally meet the court's requirement for constitutionality of these otherwise pesky people known as residents of Skid Row. So they enter into these discussions several times over several months, attempting to hammer out this consensus. Now, the issue is quite simple. The business interests represented by the city government want the Skid Row inhabitants to be removed and or criminalized, and the ACLU does not. Now, you may ask yourself, if I have a holding in hand from the court and I'm the ACLU, what possible incentive would I have to engage in a compromise? I have already won in court, and the court is found for me. So that's something to consider. And, of course, the answer to that in practical terms is that the police can use other means to harass and criminalize folks without having to resort to a law in their favor. So
but those other means, would that be a part of the compromise that they could not be used? It sounds like that was not a part of the proposed compromise. It was simply an agreement to give, you know, to set aside the sitting, sleeping, and lying law, but the police would still be allowed to move in and, you know, harass under these other pretexts.
So it was understood during the discussions and during the reporting of those discussions that so long as the police carried out their tactics, whether by the law or through other, quote, law enforcement means, that they did so between the hours of 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. So long the ACLU clung to the their respite of, so long as the Los Angeles Police Department agreed to, quote, you know, just basically leave alone the people of Skid Row between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m., then they could have the rest of the hours to do so. And this was an agreement that at the time, and this is in the months subsequent to April, was enthusiastically backed by Mayor Villaraigosa, enthusiastically backed by the Chief of Police, William Bratton, as well as some city council people. And they didn't hide their exuberance for this agreement because at the time it was considered a huge victory for the city, although it was called a compromise, that they basically got what they wanted, and so the folks would be able to only be able to sleep, you know, ostensibly at peace between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. and then enter in business interest after that, and shortly thereafter, the Los Angeles City Council on September the 20th, although everyone was of the mindset that they would vote in agreement with this compromise, surprised everyone but myself and the business interest in voting to reject the compromise.
And why did they reject the compromise? I know because I read your article, but let's ask.
Well, let's rather than me put it into my words, why don't we just see why they did and who it was that was behind them? So, Carol Schatz is the chief executive officer of the Central City Association. This is a business conglomerate. It's a commercial cartel, and you can just any one of your listeners can log on to the Central City Association, and they can see right there in About Us this quote. The Central City Association is, quote, the business membership organization representing 450 businesses which work to market and revitalize downtown L.A., CCAA's strong policy leadership of economic development and marketing resources have proven to be an incredibly powerful team, building on a strategic vision and solid relationships with key businesses and government leaders. Carol Schatz minced no words, as I wrote in the article, when she was asked what her thoughts were on the compromise allowing homeless people to sleep between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. Her quote is, any settlement that leaves people living on the street in filthy conditions and permits chaos from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. every night in one critical area of the city is unacceptable. I think that pretty much says it for itself.
It also sounds very deceptive since it has nothing to do with, you know, the chaos or anything else. It has to do with
not.
The fact that, you know, they want these people out of there so they can engage in these developmental activities
of
you're
course.
Talking about.
And they mince no words about it, Robert. I mean, the website says it itself. They're building on a strategic vision and solid relationships with key business and government leaders.
Give me the website address again.
Let me see. The website address for
what's it called, the name of the group again?
Central City Association. So,
okay, that's good. I just want to, I'm doing
so
a...
So here it is for your listeners.
Go ahead.
www.ccala.org.
www.ccala.org.
And then if you want to go precisely to the quote, it's /new/CCA_home.asp. It'll take you directly to the quote. I mean, they mince no words. They're very upfront. They're very abrasive, and they have, you know, a great deal of hubris. I mean, and that's not the only instructive reaction that I quote in the article. I mean, I talk about Estela Lopez, the chief executive officer of a similarly situated business cartel called the Central City East Association. She basically said that rules allowing, the 9 to 6 p.m. rules, allowing set hours for homeless to sleep on the sidewalk would set a dangerous precedent and worsen crime and filth in the area. And
crime
so I go on. Yeah, but here it is. I go on by saying, a claim for which she produces no evidence, not only because none exists, but because she knows Winton, the reporter, will not ask why. And why should he? Lucky for her, Winton doesn't concern himself with trivial issues, such trivial issues as evidence. Only after one considers whose interest Lopez is advocating, i.e. business interest, can her remark warning that any legal recognition of a transient's constitutional rights be understood in the proper context,
you know, we
as
have
posing
this,
a dangerous precedent.
We have the same situation here to some extent with reporters allowing these claims about crimes as the basis for restrictions on the civil rights, primarily of homeless people, to be used as a pretext without any kind of examination or call for statistics. And Santa Cruz recently passed a law that makes it illegal for you to park your car in a parking garage and stay there for more than 15 minutes. You have to leave your vehicle, allegedly for the safety of those around you and the parking lot attendants. Even though traditionally in Santa Cruz, you know, you could sit in your car and read a book all day if you wanted to, and now you can't. And there, and when we asked for crime statistics, of course, they were provided, you know, incompletely, inaccurately for different in different areas, and we got no response from the media, no questions of the kind that might reveal that. And I don't know if it was, you know, you see it as a sort of a corporate, and probably in LA it is. Here I just see it as sloppy journalism and just prejudice against homeless people and a tendency to go along with whatever city staff and the police department want done.
Agreed, Robert. Well, why can't it be both?
Could be. Could well be. We're talking with Greg Afghani, who has written a very interesting article, which you can find on the Counterpunch website, called Guilty of Being Homeless in America, Sleepless on Skid Row. I see people have been trying to call in. I'm a little bit wary of this equipment of trying to put a person on the air with you. I'm afraid I may lose you. We only have about 10 or 15 minutes left. So I'm going to suggest that callers, maybe, have you got an email address that they can address questions to? Would that be something you'd be up for?
Absolutely.
What email address can they email you at?
They can email me at gregory.afghani.
How do you spell that?
It's G-R-E-G-O-R-Y dot A, F as in Frank, G-H-A-N-I, at yahoo.com.
That's gregory.afghani at yahoo.com.
That's correct.
Okay. And that's... go ahead.
And if they have any questions, they can go ahead and reach me at that email address. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. I appreciate that. And I will be also... this will all be on the website at huffsantacruz.org for those who want to review this discussion and, you know, perhaps fill in some of the blanks. Okay, so the compromise wanted by the mayor, the city attorney, the police chief, apparently, and the ACLU, but not wanted by the business interests, was voted down by the L.A. City Council, what, September 21st or thereabouts?
September 20th, yeah, they were voted down. And the interesting thing was the reaction from state power. So this was a compromise that they were applauding and celebrating and acting as if it was a foregone conclusion. They go into city council chambers, it's voted down, they come out, and it's as if we're living in 1984 because they're immediately, it's what compromise? It's as if it never existed. They hold a hastily arranged press conference.
By they, you're talking about the police chief, the city attorney, the
mayor? The two major players here. The city attorney works behind the scenes in formulating the opinions and giving counsel, but I'm talking specifically
mayor and
about
the police chief?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So they come out and have this press conference, and you can tell it's hastily arranged. It's within hours after the vote, and they had to have been shocked. But they come out and act as if this is exactly what was wanted the whole time, although they're quoted as saying it was crucial that it would pass. You know, Bratton came up and said, I hope they decide to vote in favor of this compromise. He called it crucial. And then right after they voted to reject it, he came out and acted he acted as if it didn't exist and vowed to fight crime and clean up Skid Row. And at the same time, Rocky Delgadillo's office was working feverishly to undermine the court's ruling.
And that's the city attorney.
That's correct.
So subsequent to this, of course, you've gone into, I don't know if we have time to go into in detail, the kind of deceptive and bad faith reporting that went into what's so-called dumping of hospital homeless on Skid Row as though that were the major issue and they're taking Kaiser to task for it. But in reality, the police and city authorities have colluded in that for some time. Is that the suggestion?
That's absolutely the case. So, Mr. Wynn, what he did is, and this is interesting because I predicted this in the article.
This is the L.A. Times writer who did this?
This is the L.A. Times writer. So he originally was the author of an article that first shed light on a term that he coined, by the way, that I find highly offensive, and that's the dumping of homeless people as if they're trash, because you'd never dump off CEOs of a company or dump off a white middle-class family, but you do dump off homeless people, apparently. But so he wrote this article about how law enforcement agencies and and hospital workers have been caught dumping people off. And so he wrote that back in 2005 and never recounted that story again in his reporting in 2006. But the interesting thing was, if you did your research and read the court's holding, the court actually cites the article in talking about the problem of increasing numbers of homeless people not having social services in Skid Row. And
you're talking about the court in the Jones decision.
The court in the Jones decision, right, cites Richard Winton's article about the dumping of homeless people. Then I noticed in all the subsequent articles, he deftly maneuvers to make sure that there's no mention of especially the law enforcement agencies who were caught dumping people, but also the medical personnel. And then recently, he finally does sensationalize only the hospital corporations who were caught dumping, not the law enforcement agencies. The part that really takes the cake is after he mentioned the law enforcement agencies and the hospitals in his original article in 2005, he backed up that claim by saying that the legislature was looking at beefing up the budget for law enforcement agencies to do what? To stop other law enforcement agencies from dumping off homeless people? So, of course, he hides that, and now he comes out with Kaiser Permanente being caught dumping someone. Now, I have no dispute. They actually were caught doing that. I've never disputed the fact of the hospitals or law enforcement agencies doing this. But you have to look at the reason why. And if you understand the whole essence of the sleep ban, you understand the whole essence of the misinformation campaign, you understand the whole essence of the, quote, mega project reshaping L.A. growth that was in yesterday's paper, then you understand a simple equation. If you have a sleep ban in place and you have a 50-block radius and you want to cleanse that area of the homeless people, any entity that attempts to bring additional individuals into the area you want to cleanse is going to be troublesome. So suddenly Kaiser is the bad guy and needs to be vilified. And who does the vilification? Well, Winton does the vilification as the mouthpiece for Los Angeles Times, and Rocky Delgadillo's office, working in, quote, the strong building relationship with key government leaders and business leaders, is doing the work behind the scenes to run investigations of a criminal and civil nature against Kaiser. Not that they don't deserve it, mm-hmm, but the fact that the law enforcement agencies are left out of the equation, although they've been caught dumping people down there, and what the overall essence is, remove people from Skid Row.
So, Greg, who are the good guys here, and what counterforces, if any, other than you and maybe the ACLU, have been brought to bear? You mentioned LA and LA Action. I know the LA Action Coalition, maybe the LA. How's the LA Coalition for End Hunger and Homelessness been behaving? Do you have any sense of other groups, or how have churches in the area been responding?
There are many, many activist groups, many good people working behind the scenes, many good people working in the streets to help with social services, to help the situation. And there's definitely a lot of vigor in the activism there. Well, but the difference is that the media mouthpiece in Los Angeles is not going to report on that. They're not going to report on the good deeds being done by the people on the ground to help the homeless folks, to help advocate for them, both on legal grounds and on quality of life grounds. Instead, what Winton and his cohorts focus on is the 50 additional officers that the LAPD has sent to Skid Row since the compromise was struck down by City Council to help, quote, clean up Skid Row. And what they've been doing is, because they're in current negotiations with the ACLU, they're not strictly enforcing the 9-to-6 ban, but they're violating the spirit of the 9-to-6 ban by committing drug arrests or violating people's right to search and seizure, by citing them for, quote, quality of life offenses, by picking them up on outstanding warrants, by doing all sorts of other means and machinations to make sure that they scurry away the homeless. And it's been effective, Robert. I got to tell you, I'm quoting from articles from the LA Times talking about the fact that it had an effect. The effect has been that it's cleansed the area. In fact, Skid Row Life is Like Day and Night is another article by Richard Witten, published in October the 21st, talking about how homeless people in the area have been scurried off. During the day, they are afraid to even take advantage of the social services that are put in place for them. So they don't go to the Union Rescue Mission. They don't go to drug and other kinds of rehabilitation centers because they don't want to be harassed by police. And he put it right there in his article.
So what... Let me see if actually we can get this caller in. I'm going to have to work on this equipment. Hang tough with me here, Greg. You may have to call me back, but I'm going to see if I can actually get this guy. And it sounds like he has a question. In fact, let me find out for a moment off the air what the question is. Just a second. I think we've lost both people here. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay. Sorry, caller. It's going to have to happen another time. Maybe on Sunday, or maybe you can email Greg your question. That's gregory.afghani@yahoo.com. We're talking with Gregory Afghani, who's presenting an alternate view. Any other alternate views or sources you recommend for folks who want to get more information? I know you put a lot of focus on Winton of the L.A. Times and analyzing, his slant, his bias, what he selects, and how he serves certain interests. Are there any other sources you recommend for people who want to get information on what's happening with the L.A. homeless?
Absolutely. The sources I recommend are go straight to the horse's mouth. So when wondering what the motives are behind the business interests, you don't need to listen to me or believe what I have to say or get the skewed misinformation from Witten. Go directly to the website for folks like the Central City East organizations, the Central City organization, folks like Carol Schatz and Estella Lopez and the ones who are advocating for the cleansing of that area.
Well, actually, I'm looking for how can we get information about what's happening on Skid Row from objective sources about, they don't sound objective to me. They sound like they have their own bias and they'll reveal their bias. But how do we get news? I mean, are there other news sources
Sure.
you recommend?
Sure. If you're really interested in what's happening on the ground, you can get in contact with the director of the Los Angeles County Action Network, who's intimately involved in the homeless issues of Skid Row as well as Greater Los Angeles.
Website or perhaps?
Yeah, his name is Pete White. He's the director, and he can be reached at www.cangress.org, and that's the website for, again, the Los Angeles Community Action Network.
Again, it's C-A-N-G as in girl, R-E as in eek, S-S as in Sam?
.org, that's correct.
That's cangress.org?
That's correct.
Yeah, I know Pete White, actually. He was with the L.A. Coalition for... to end homelessness and hunger.
Right. And so if you want to get an unvarnished account of the repressive tactics that are used by the LAPD and city government and the misinformation and whatnot, and you want an accurate view of what's actually happening on the street and happening on the ground, Pete White's a great resource. The Union Rescue Mission in downtown is also a wonderful resource. There's many different community organizations and downtown community activist groups that you can get a hold of. Another one is Catherine Morris at the LA Catholic Worker Soup Kitchen. That's another great resource. I mean, she was quoted in one of Winton's recent articles, letting him know that the LAPD's tactics have driven the homeless away from the exact types of social services that the court was looking for.
Greg, what do we see on the horizon? What do you predict coming up in the next few months?
I think the next few months will be very telling because right now the ACLU and the city government are in intensive negotiations to try to hammer through this compromise again. And so the city council will be involved again as to either ratifying or rejecting that. If it's a rejection, there will be a very contentious appeal, and that will set the course that will affect the precedent that will have a definite and stark effect on places like Santa Cruz and other areas in the Bay and anywhere in California as well as in the Ninth Circuit. The decision to either uphold the finding of the court that it's unconstitutional to cleanse people off the streets, or the compromise, which will remove it from precedent and work about a feasible agreement between the powers that be in Los Angeles and the homeless folks that
Greg,
have to suffer.
What's the status? Let's suppose the settlement efforts don't work. It goes to a higher court. Right now, the decision is actually on hold because it's under appeal, right? In theory, L.A. police could move in and continue arresting people all they want because there's no, you know, it's not the law right now. It's on appeal. Is that that's my understanding.
No, absolutely not.
That's not true.
No, the it may be on appeal, but as long as it's the stated law, then it is a valid law until the appeal is either overturned or not overturned. So as it stands, the current law is that the LAPD cannot do that, and that's why they are not violating folks, at least on the grounds of sleeping between 9 to 6.
Well, I'm running out of time here. In fact, I've run out of time, or I will in a moment. But, you know, my understanding, I want to talk to you more about this because local ACLU attorneys here tell me that because the decision has been appealed, it's on hold, and therefore, in a certain sense, I mean, the LA authorities can, in their own way, do what they want because it can't be enforced until it's upheld.
Well, the status of the law currently is that the law is unconstitutional to arrest people for doing that. Because I think their opinion might be derived from the fact that because the ACLU and city government are involved in negotiations, that is making it so that the decision is up in the air. The decision has not been ratified by the higher court. But until it's overturned, that's the status of the law. In other words, if the law wasn't now that the homeless people could stay there, then there would be no reason for appeal, right?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, unfortunately, is I'm out of time. I really appreciate you being with me, Greg. I wish I had more time to talk about this. And let's possibly schedule another update because you know it's really been educational talking with you.
Most definitely. I really appreciate the opportunity. I thank you for that. And if we can get back together, I can tell you more about the workings behind the scenes from at least the different perspectives.
I'll try to call you tomorrow so we can maybe do some informal updating off air, and I can pass on the information to people on Sunday.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate it.
All righty. Bye-bye. We've been talking with Greg Afghani, a writer for numerous people, but also specifically on counterpunch.org, where he's written an article about the homeless in Skid Row. You can go to it by going to counterpunch.org and Googling for Greg Afghani. It's like the, you know, Afghanistan, A-F-G-H-A-N-I. This is That's It for Bathrop Spears Broadsides for tonight. Coming up next, it's From the Cream to the Dregs with Uncle Dennis, who's setting up even as we speak. I want to thank you for being with me. I apologize for there not being any call-in room. I tried it once, and I lost my caller, and I obviously have to get some more training here from Uncle Dennis at some point or one of the other techies. But come on back on Sunday at 8:30 in the morning. We're going to have Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs calling in, special guest. I'll be kind of co-hosting with Thomas Levitt as part of his The Wake-Up Call for that particular interview. Interesting stuff. I recommend you check it out. In the meantime, if you've got stuff you've witnessed on the streets or questions or you want to help out, 423-HUFF, 423-4833 is the number to call for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop's Piers Broadsides.
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 and www.freakradio.org. I'm Uncle Dennis, sitting here in the nicely warmed chair on a Thursday night. You're tuned into a show called From the Cream to the Dregs, and we're going to explore the music of the 60s and the 70s. Of course, that was a cover of a Beatles tune by a group called Vanilla Fudge. And we will be playing some more Vanilla Fudge here for a while. It's a new CD in my collection, and we might as well play the darn thing through. So sit back, relax. We will be hearing some more Vanilla Fudge and some other things. We've got some requests for last week, which I can actually fulfill this week. So stay tuned. Lots more music coming up. So just say goodbye to Robert. Goodbye, Robert.
Goodbye, Uncle Dennis.
We'll see Robert on Sunday. I won't see him on Sunday. You'll hear him on Sunday. If you see him, say hi, Robert. Anyway, lots of stuff here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. Hope you enjoy it. And once again, we're going to get back to the Vanilla Fudge.